You can start anytime you want. I'm ready to go.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. This is our open session to talk with Stephen Downs. I thought that this is, since it's a smaller group, we might actually go around and just introduce ourselves, just very quickly, just say who you are and what you do here. So we'll start with Sally.
Hi, I'm Sally DeForest, Assistant Area Coordinator for Humanities.
Hi, I'm Mara Kaufman, Associate Professor of Nursing.
Nicola Martinez, I'm a faculty member in Humanities and Digital Media, and I oversee the digital media area.
Jill Bubin, I'm the assistant to the provost, and I mentor students virtually through CDL.
I'm here under Jill's umbrella. Jill and I are doctoral students at Lesley University, and my area is connectedness and research area, so that's why I'm here.
You realize I am formally unqualified to help you.
Good. I'm very happy to be here.
I'll be Kim Stoat, Academic Area Coordinator here at Center for Distance Learning and Health Services.
Betty Lawrence, Interim Associate Dean, also a faculty member in Science, Math, and Technology, focusing on math education.
Carol Yeager, currently with Center for Distance Learning, been around a long time, probably unqualified to teach anything.
Sarah Daly, I'm a CDL mentor, I instruct the course in teaching learning, and you've completely changed how I'm going to approach the conference. I've changed my sessions because you got into the head of my 8-year-old autistic grandson with your last presentation, and I really want to figure out how his mind works as well as the minds of some of my students. You
know,
you learn about one area.
That's interesting.
Hi, I'm Cindy Conaway. I'm the ARIC coordinator here at CDL for Media Studies and Communication.
I'm Chris Warren. I teach mostly international business in our center in New York City, and I'm very interested in themes of innovation and disruption in education.
Edward
Donna,
Board of Design.
I'm Michelle Ogle. I'm an interim area coordinator in the practice area and looking at the resources
I'm Lawrence Robinson. I'm a very part-time instructor in math and of course the fun course developer.
I'm Kathy Wisdom.
Jennifer Blue, soon to be in July, area coordinator of mathematics, currently residing at RPI,
Diane Schurken, faculty coach, I'm teaching for some time. I'm also an area coordinator in science, math, and technology, primarily focusing on engineering.
Teaching a course on time?
Time management, and sociocultural construction of time.
We were just having a conversation about the benefits and disadvantages of having a watch or not having a watch.
Based on your comments.
And whether it's a digital or an analog.
Yeah.
And the difference is there. I had a student who did an experiment who I had them who, you know, are wearing watches, take them off. This student never wore a watch and decided to try it as his experiment.
Oh, yeah.
Made him a nervous wreck after 3 days. He wrote to me and said, I know the experiment's supposed to run me. I can't do this.
I believe it, yeah. It's funny, though, because the course on time, I took a course on time once. But it was metaphysics. So, and actually, I read Jay McTaggart's paper, The Unreality of Time, which was very influential on me. So, he said, time? Oh, time, you teach time here.
And yes, we do, because this came about in conversations about students who proposed, could they get part of an assessment credit for time management. So, having conversations. What is college level? And you know, our social studies need this.
Oh, yeah.
But we don't want to impose that traditional time management on them. Let's help them think about time.
Yeah.
And we went
to that. I like that. Yeah.
I'm Ronnie Gaither. I'm a faculty member in psychology.
Hi, I'm Lisa Sass. I'm the Director of Corporate and Community Partnerships.
And Betsy?
Hi, I'm Betsy Braun. I'm a Curriculum Design Specialist working here at the Online Courses.
Thanks, everybody. I'm going to completely take advantage of my role as facilitator and ask the first question. And then everyone else can ask as many questions as you want. I was really interested in one of the first things that you talked about, which was what you call this nexus between or among language, literacy, and libraries. And I'm really interested in libraries. I think a lot of people make assumptions about libraries in the digital age and that maybe they're not as relevant. But we know that public libraries play an important role in communities. Academic libraries play an important role in universities and colleges. And I think libraries in particular have been really smart about reinventing themselves for the kinds of changes that we've seen. So that's just my opinion about it. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that nexus with a particular focus on libraries.
No, nothing like a zinger to start. It's interesting because I read just 2 days ago an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education from a librarian, I don't know if you saw it, but which was atrocious, but it's the Chronicle of Higher Education, so I had to get my dig in. Just in case you're curious, I am broadcasting on the radio, and we have zero listeners. I even tweeted it, but nobody came. So I don't know. Libraries. You did say this was informal. the library is a collection of books. Other than a place to keep them as historical artifacts, is on the way out. I mean, we know this, right? The idea of reading books on paper, while right now incredibly convenient, will, I'd say within 5 years, probably sooner, be seen as incredibly inconvenient. And there's so many reasons. And it's interesting because if you look at videos I've done, you see the rows of books behind me. And, I have thousands of books at home, and this is after dispossessing myself of my science fiction collection. But it was all paperback, and it was all, like, molding. It was becoming compost. It's exactly what it was doing. And I love those books. I've read tens of thousands of science fiction books. I have read more science fiction than anything. And that includes stuff I've studied deliberately. I should be speaking as somebody who's learned in science fiction, but I'm not. But it didn't make sense for me to keep my own science fiction books. And I took them to the used bookstore and they wouldn't take them. And, I've got, like, first edition William Tens, and they wouldn't take them. And if you know science fiction, first edition William Tens aren't just kicking around. I mean, this is a book they can sell for, like, $7-$8. I guess that's not a whole lot. It's Moncton, so it's a small city. We have one chain bookstore, and you go into it, and over time, it's been fewer and fewer books. They hardly sell books anymore. And I saw a Chapters of Barnes & Noble or Borders. I didn't go in it, but I'll bet you it's the same here.
Oh,
it's closed.
Just closed down.
I was in... You want to know trends, you go to Las Vegas. I was in Las Vegas my one and only time, and possibly the only time I'll ever go there with any luck. I was in Las Vegas, and I was looking for CDs, but then I expanded my search because I like to buy CDs still because it's cheap media. I could store the music anywhere, but the plastic disc is actually cheaper than buying flash memory still. So, no CD stores that I could find in Las Vegas on the Strip, no bookstores, nothing like that. Found a couple of Apple stores, no surprise there. But that was pretty much it for computers too, which is interesting. So libraries, and you know, I say like language is being redefined, and I mean that very literally. And the physical evidence that language is being redefined is the fact that our current repositories of language are either closed down or now selling mugs, which is a great phrase, and I'll have to remember that. But it's literally true. You go into the Chapters in Moncton, that's where you buy mugs, which is very strange. Libraries, you're quite correct, libraries have reinvented themselves, and the Chronicle article talked about this, and I've seen this myself. They're reinventing themselves as gathering places, which interestingly is what Chapters did in Canada. I'm not sure if you have Chapters here or not. No. It's like Barnes & Noble, I guess, or Indigo. Do you have Indigo? No? Because they bought Chapters. Okay. Usually when a store in Canada is bought, it's by some American chain. It's the Canadian development business development model. We build something really cool, we sell it to Americans. It's true. It's WebCT, made by Canadians, sold to Americans. Anyhow, where was I? Reinventing themselves. What Chapters did is basically signed agreements with Starbucks. Starbucks, of course, was reinventing the coffee shop as a place where you hang out and read books. The bookstore reinvented itself as the place where you hang out and drink coffee. And that's actually working. And it's interesting because in Moncton, the bookstore is near the movie theater. And so when I go see a movie, because I still go see movies. I love going to movies. I'm not even sure about the whole 3D thing. But I love going to movies because I'll never have a 60-foot screen in my house. Well, except you're all sitting in a dark room not talking to each other, and you complain if somebody talks. So it's not that social. but there is that aspect of going out and people watching, and you know, and then you go to the bookstore after and have some coffee. And that's libraries, right? Now, I'm almost done. I'm sorry. Okay. But I do want to make, there was one point.
Libraries, though.
Pardon?
Bookstores are not libraries.
Bookstores are not libraries, but I mean, if you're thinking of the library simply as a place to keep your books, there are far better things you could be doing with that space. Seriously. Far, far better things, because you can keep your books on a device the size of this computer and use all of that space for other things. And that's where we're headed. Now, there will be a need for archives and repositories, and we're really stupid if we depend on digital media for all of our books forever. I mean, we learned that lesson with the last new technology called paper. When they introduced it, they thought, let's get all of our knowledge together, we'll put it on paper, we'll put it in a big building called a library, and then people came along and burned it down. And then we lost all that knowledge. So we won't make that mistake again. But we don't need a library in every town. We don't need a library in every school. In the sense of piles of paper books. We do need, what do we need? We don't need a mechanism whereby a whole system is set up to lend you digital content. There's been some stuff about that coming across my radar recently, and that is so ridiculous. And the most recent thing I saw, I forget which publisher it was, doesn't matter because they'd all do it. Selling digital books to libraries for lending that would expire after, I think, what was it, 24 or 26 uses? They wouldn't even get away with that in paper. And I know most of these books are only loaned 24, 26 times, probably on average, but it's ridiculous. So the concept of a library as a repository of stuff that will be loaned on a temporary basis is silly. So what have we got left? We still have some useful things left. First of all, is the meeting space. And, you know, the same Chronicle articles defended the libraries by saying, look, our libraries at Harvard are packed. And your libraries at Harvard are packed because there's no other place to go. You know, it's all like big buildings, trees and lawns where you go to the library. So there is that. There is the service that librarians provide. And, you know, I can be kind of vague, but services, but we want to be careful here because a lot of these services are being disintermediated as well. The service is typically along the lines of curation, along the lines of document retrieval, search, discovery, research skills, those sorts of things. Those are important skills to have. If we do the little flip thing with the thing is, you know, the change of language, these all become aspects of using language, and we can talk about that. But these are more and more things that people should be doing for themselves rather than requiring a librarian to do. Just as people more and more should be able to learn for themselves rather than requiring the intermediary of the teacher to do. And there's a whole conversation we could have on that. So we need to be careful. But the third thing, and final thing, because I did say about 10 minutes ago I was almost done. Sorry about that. And the point I wanted to make at the start. print is becoming digital. And by the fact of becoming digital, is now being found side by side, literally side by side, physically side by side. Here are some video bits, here are some print bits. And so print no longer, text, paragraphs, sentences, words, letters, no longer stand apart the way they always have from other media. They are in literally the very same place, often embedded together. I mean, it's the illuminated text, only in reverse, right? And that changes the nature of print. It certainly removes it from its privileged position, but it also means, and this is one of the themes of the talk, we are less and less inclined to come up with rules that only apply to print. For rules, by rules I mean like rules for interpretation, rules for understanding, rules for comprehending. We are less and less inclined to apply literacy only to print. Literacy now means any kinds of content, and what it means to be literate means skills that are applied equally to print, to photos, to videos, to statues, to pictures of horses, to understanding why in the coffee shop every rack is named after a horse and has a date after it. So understanding food. All of that is... I know. I'll have an affirmed, please, 1947. And in this strange, bizarre sense, that makes sense. And even making this observation is not possible in a world where literacy applies to writing. So it's not... I mean, we always hear, right, there's literacy, and then there's math literacy, emotional literacy, digital literacy, frog literacy, whatever, right? But there isn't. There's literacy. And literacy consists, maybe, depending on how it resolves, of those six basic areas that I outlined, or seven or five, I don't know, scholars will do what scholars do. And it isn't just text anymore. So what is a library in that environment? A place where people meet, a place that promotes literacy, a place where people communicate and create. It's not a storehouse anymore. It's something different. Now, you had a follow-up.
I'm actually really interested in this because you sort of named the three or four things. So I'm thinking about what we led you to do for the fifth, which is a way, and you were talking earlier about sort of the linearity of knowledge and how we connect with this world.
Mm-hmm.
We're no longer thinking of these things in the same linear way.
Right.
Part of what a library gives us, or has historically given us, is a cataloging system.
Mm.
You know, a linear way to think about knowledge. And I'm curious now in this environment if that linear way of thinking about knowledge, I started out as a studying African politics, and so I think of things in terms of DD449.7 blah blah blah,
yeah,
as the Library of Congress cataloging system for this thing I know or want to learn about.
Yeah.
So I always know if I want to learn more about then I go there. If I want to learn about development, I can obviously get an HC800 blah blah blah. How do we cope with that in this kind of climate?
If you want to get into an argument, go to a traditional artificial intelligence theorist and say, there are no fixed categories. And he'll melt in front of you. He'll like, no, there must be. Thought is not possible otherwise. I've had lots of arguments about that exact topic, oddly enough, simply because the semantic web was designed as, first of all, a way to address this. Now, how do you catalog all the information on the web? Well, you build a cataloging system, which is what the semantic web is supposed to be. But then you come to the realization different people catalog things differently. So you get the actual semantic web that they built, which is a cataloging system plus a schema system to define the catalogs. Okay, well that's good, except that's not good enough either because people think there are different things in the world and they're organized differently. For example, to take an obvious example, some people believe there is an entity called God that exists, and therefore should be put in the nonfiction section of the library. Other people believe there is no such entity, and therefore such work should be put in the fiction. Well, okay, that's ontology 101, right? But you can get into even more, what do you say about the existence of dragons? What do you say about the existence of rocks? So a whale is a mammal. Do you put it near people, or do you still put it near swimming things? Ontology is a big... So the semantic web, in addition to schemas, has ontologies. And ontologies are... And web people came along and invented tagging. And tagging ignores all of that. And tagging is a system whereby if you think a word applies to a thing, you apply it to the thing. I was going to tie that into duck typing, but it's not going to work. Duck typing is a. Never mind. If you're interested in databases and typing and schemes, look up duck typing. It's really interesting. But what that gives you is a non-ontology ontology. There is no classifier of things anymore. It's a classic example of when I talked about emergent knowledge during my talk. This is a classic case of emergent knowledge, where the categories emerge as a result of each individual person applying a word to a thing. And there's something to that. Now, there's lots of problems with tagging. And I don't think tagging is the way we want to organize the world. I really don't. But tagging, yeah, you see all the librarians all of a sudden, and pretty much everyone else, too. And I nearly caused a riot when I said that at Northern Voice, which is an avant-garde web conference in Vancouver. And tagging had just come out, and everybody was thinking, tagging, yes, would do away with ontologies and schemas and classifications. Everybody will just apply words to things, and it'll be beautiful. And it was, until we got spammers. Which took about 10 minutes. But the concept is still sound, and the concept is there is no arbiter of classifications. People do classify things individually. We just need to be smarter about how we organize and bring together these independent classifications. Instead of just mashing everybody's classifications into a big single mob and then counting them, which is what tagging does, we want to see these things self-organize into networks. There's a classic, brilliant diagram, and I almost used it in my presentation, except I couldn't find it while I was watching the royal wedding this morning. But what it is, it's a network diagram. I've put it in my newsletter, and you'll probably find it if you search for it. It's a network diagram, and it has all of the disciplines. So, you know, math, geology, physics, etc., except there's like 1,000 of them. And they're linked according to whether works in one discipline refer to works in another discipline.
Not right now.
And destroy images.
Because we had a workshop yesterday, we actually were talking about interconnectedness and interdisciplinarity and how to do that. So.
Found it. So here. And so it's really hard to read, but.
Is it postable on Facebook?
Oh, yeah.
Can we get it doing?
I'm sure we could.
You would need the adapter.
Oh, I have an adapter in there. Okay, that would be even faster. I just have to muddle through Google Images' broken system. It really is bad now. There we go. Oh, okay, they ran a version of it in the New York Times even. Those of you who are on Twitter, I'm going to tweet the URL in about 10 seconds here. I just need to get to the page. All right, it's out. My Twitter ID is Downes, D-O-W-N-E-S. Jeez, I almost spelled my name wrong. Oh, yeah. Okay. So. Pardon? Oh, do I? Let me check. Oh, no, you can't.
Doesn't give you names.
I have one, yes, I do have one. Mine doesn't give me names, it's anonymous.
Okay.
Yep, I do have one listener. So, hi, one listener on Ed Radio. it doesn't matter, I'm still recording the audio, so there's the. Oh, who's doing that up? Okay. Should be looking for line in or something like that. Presenter? Nope.
Hmm.
There, that's it.
That's it, but it's not showing up there.
Okay, but you've got half the battle.
Hmm.
Can you see presenter? I just need to.
Oh.
Oh, okay. So, okay, well, good enough. It'll be up there. Oh, I see.
I don't know why. Oh, maybe I need to get out of this. Let's see.
Out of utilities? Let's see. No.
Maybe the old-fashioned way is...
Yeah, the old-fashioned way. Sorry. I don't know why we're kind of stuck here.
The old-fashioned way. Ha!
There might be... There it
is. Did I pass it already? Oh, yeah, here we go. There it is. I've tweeted the link. And there's the diagram.
But you'll email the link out of us.
So, this is actual data. It's not made-up data. And it's actually incomplete data. And so, this is actual citations from one scientific paper to another scientific paper. It's based only on scientific papers. So, it's very incomplete. But because... the discipline of publishing scientific papers is fairly regimented. It means that spam is limited to pharmacology. No, I'm just kidding. It means that, but it does control the input somewhat. Probably too much. But nonetheless, we still see a pretty good illustration of the phenomenon. And the phenomenon is of emergent classification or emergent clustering. And we can see that happening there. We can see, and it's really hard for me to see, the blue on the right-hand side is like physical chemistry, organic chemistry, polymers, applied physics, and all that sort of stuff. The green at the bottom, physiology, agriculture, genetics, marine biology, and you can see there's going to be quite a bit of links between the organic chemistry and the agriculture and the biology. The yellow center, economics, education, Asian studies, international studies, anthropology. And again, you can sort of see a natural clustering happening there. And then we have the fringe disciplines off on the far left, nursing, social work, dermatology, and brain studies, and way almost off by itself in the lower left-hand side, language. It's interesting. So, but they're connected. And so we get connection and clustering as emergent phenomena. And these emergent phenomena provide us, at least now, with the beginnings of an alternative to manual classification systems. And so that's where that's heading.
Then we're talking about emergent knowledge, so
yeah.
You would have to have an emergent phenomena of our classification of it because it's always going to be changing and emerging.
Mm-hmm.
Is that not?
It's not static.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So part of what I've been kind of been working with recently and presenting tomorrow morning is looking at. What today you talked about pretty much conventional pedagogy, content-driven courses and knowledge, and instead of personal learning environments. So as we move into more of the development of personal learning environments, then looking at a new, and I'm using the term egogy, a new something that fits for e-teaching, e-learning. Moving into new theoretical bases and thinking about who's doing what and doing some literature search on that. So that's kind of why I wanted to get the question in, to pick your brain about who in the field and where, because you're traveling and working and all this, and also very non-content-driven in your own thinking, who are some of the people that would be good to look for that are working on that maybe right now that aren't yet published or in combination and published a little, because I found older things and mill things in terms of articles and stuff.
Yeah, if we relied on traditional paper-based academic publishing, we'd find out about this in 2020. Or I'm serious. I mean, the stuff that, anyhow.
Two listeners, one from Italy.
Oh, one from Italy. Hi, Italian person.
Sylvia.
Sylvia. Hi, Sylvia. Name one other radio station where you get a personal greeting from the people on the radio station just for listening. You don't even have to call in. Because you are the listener. But that we saw that phenomenon in DS-106 radio too, where all the listeners knew each other and were known to the anyhow. And I did catch that. I just want to answer that. And I'm just trying to remember the question.
She said hi.
Oh, isn't that nice?
Who are the people to look at for research?
Oh, yeah, right. That area, the work in the field.
That are moving into emerging pedagogical, andragogical theory, all the authentic learning, all the different terms of the new words that we're using.
In my world, and it's a bit outside, what you're describing is a bit outside my world for certain reasons. I put that under the heading of learning design, and there are different aspects to learning design. There's the pedagogical aspect and the technical aspect. Probably the world expert in the technical aspect is Rob Koper from the Open University of the Netherlands. He designed the educational modeling language, which later became IMS Learning Design. He's now working on learning networks and similar phenomena. Never mind. There are others. What's his name? James Dalziel, who developed something called LAMS, Learning Activity Management System. He's based in, I believe, Sydney, Australia. Might be Melbourne. Dalziel, Dalziel, I think. We'll just verify that. Now I got a computer here, right? So I got like having half my brain back.
Dalziel and Pasco?
Pardon?
Dalziel and Pasco, or just
Dalziel? Dalziel, James Dalziel, Macquarie University. See, I knew that, it's just I don't know where Macquarie is. Anyhow, and the product is LAMS. LAMS is very good, and it's open source software, and it will support learning design. The pedagogy side, probably the major work is being done by Grania Knoll, and it's not spelled how it's pronounced. Grainne Knoll, which is a ridiculous way of spelling a name. Sorry, Grania, but I called her Grain Knoll for the longest time. And then she said, no, it's Grania, like Sonia. That's how to remember it. And she's done a lot of work on learning design and what's been called open pedagogy. And if you follow my slides, which I'll post on my website later today, and there's the link there, the different stages of open knowledge or open learning, and there's the reference to Taylor's paper that was cited by John Daniel. John Daniel refers specifically to Grania Knoll and someone else whose name I forget, and their work. And their work is very good and very authoritative. There's also work that's been done by, it's not Diane Laurillard, it's the other one. Learning design patterns. That's not it. Maybe it is Laurillard. Diana Laurillard. Diana Laurillard, Laurillard. Another good person to invite. So is Grania Knoll. She's a very good speaker. I've seen her speak. She's really interesting. And these are all variations on the theme. And the theme is identifying common elements in pedagogy, implementing them in some kind of technology, and then filling them with variables that represent local conditions or current learning, etc. I see my video is running here. I don't want that to run. Why kill the bandwidth for no reason? Learning design goes further and will actually... The best I've heard it described is as using the metaphor of a play. So you have not only sequences of activities and not only decisions on which activities used based on the results of other activities, but also the organization of the participants into different roles. So, and then you orchestrate the learning activity as though it were a play with all the different people doing their different roles. So it's pretty interesting. It involves a lot of overhead. A guy called Guillaume Durand, G-U-I-L-L-A-U-M-E, Durand, D-U-R-A-N-D, and I wrote a paper called Simple Learning Design, or SLD, which attempts to take that concept and make it a lot more accessible, because it's really hard to do learning design technologically, as I'm sure you can imagine, right? You just imagine taking your typical classroom and trying to represent that as a piece of software. And it's almost impossible. Any sort of activity-based thing is really difficult to replicate in software. My approach is different. This is the big divide, really. My approach is to create an environment and to populate that environment with objects. I use the metaphor of the horse and the palm tree. And what it is I was in Australia, in the Sunshine Coast. Same trip, I saw the cave paintings on Kakadu. It was a very productive trip. And I'm at this farm out in the mountains near the Sunshine Coast, and there's this open area, and then just like sheer jungle, right, because it was like Queensland. And in this open area, there's a single palm tree and a horse. And I'm thinking, talk about your non-natural combination, right? Palm tree, not designed for a horse. Horse, definitely not designed for a palm tree. But there they are in the same environment interacting. Right. And so I realized that it's not, you don't design these things. You don't design and orchestrate palm trees and horses. You couldn't possibly pull it off. The number of variables involved is just too great. But you design horses well, so that a horse can interact with a palm tree should it ever come up. And you design palm trees well so that they interact, you know, the horse comes along, leans on the palm tree, it doesn't fall over. And so if you designed the individual entities in an environment well, then you can have these entities interact with each other. And that's more of an object-oriented way of learning design. That's the model that I've used in designing learning environments and the work that we did in at NRC to build something called PLERN. Nothing to release yet. Lawyers. Don't get me started about lawyers and IP people. But
Ryan has a question.
Yeah.
And then Cindy?
That was smart. You stopped me when I...
No, I'm sorry.
That's fine. No problem.
I have to do my job as well.
Yeah, because I could have kept going on that for the rest of the... I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I hope that helped.
So Ronnie, Cindy, and Ed. I was wondering
about the applicability of the PLE that you outlined. It seems to support an educational autonomy and expertise,
mm-hmm.
that a lot of our students don't have or don't seem to have.
Mm-hmm.
It also seems to abstract from the social and economic realities that we face in the sense of time that we have.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that they could select aspects of something like behavioral neuroscience and then move on to discuss behavior and neuroscience in that sense.
Yeah.
It's difficult to understand. It also raises interesting questions about expertise. Expertise is both a good thing and a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing in the sense of, in the world of credentialism, but it could also, the model that you outline could also lead to thoroughgoing relativism.
Mm-hmm.
That might, under the certain things, certain bodies of the APA might not appreciate. So that's what concerns me, is how applicable that is to where our students are.
Sure. You're describing that phenomenon described by Andrew Keen, the rise of amateurism, the death of the professional, etc., which is ironic because Keen himself is an amateur.
That's right. But there's also a sense of security that comes from reality. Security is as basic as employment in human beings.
Yeah.
And a lot of our students find that there's a security, a beginning, a middle, and an end in the LMS.
Mm-hmm. First of all, it's come up. And Rita Kopp, who works at NRC&I, did a course called Critical Literacies. And the reason why we did this course was specifically to address the question of whether we could use the method that we are describing in order to teach the literacies required to be successful to use the method we are describing. I'll take that not as an editorial comment. I'm just kidding.
There's another session.
Oh, I see. Okay. No, that's fine.
Yes.
I did a talk at ALT once, and that's a big national British conference. And the theme was collaboration. And I introduced my talk by saying, the reason why this talk will work is because you can leave anytime you want. Collaboration is not like that. And then I launched into an hour-long attack on collaboration. They were appreciative, actually, now that I think about it. Anyhow, different issue. I'd say the results of that course were inconclusive. I didn't expect to prove it one way or another. One of the outcomes of that course was that we applied the sixfold attributes of language that I talked about. Because, I mean, the first question we have to ask, right, is what are the skills that are necessary in order to be successful in this environment? Because people usually say things like, well, they need to be motivated or able to self-motivate, manage their time well, they'll need literacy skills of some sort, etc. I mean, you could go through the list, right? I'm not sure those are the skills that people need. Well, that was interesting. Because a lot of those skills, you take motivation, for example, are required by the traditional system because you've got a bunch of unwilling people put into uncomfortable rooms, told to do unnatural things to learn stuff that they know they'll never use. And so they do need skills to cope with that. It does not follow that they need those same skills online in a connectivist environment. So we need to interpret the question, right? What are the skills? I think that set of six types of critical literacy are those skills. That's my best guess. We attempted to test that. It seems to test okay. But, you know, I mean, it's an empirical question. It's an open empirical question as to whether people can learn those skills online in a connectivist way or whether we need some other supportive mechanism to teach them.
They can learn skills, but can they do without the content? I mean, I looked in one of your slides, you said there is no curriculum.
Yeah. Can they do without the content? Almost unequivocally, yes.
They can do without the content of behavioral neuroscience or abnormal psychology.
Let me be more precise now. Okay. Even though I was unequivocal, and I still am, I want to be more precise. There is no specific content that anyone needs. It does not follow from that no one needs any content. You see the distinction, right? Right, it's like food, right? There is no specific food that anyone needs. Right? But it does not follow that everyone needs no food. Everyone needs food.
Can you generalize that to the sciences? I'm sorry. We need oxygen to live. Or, but I don't know. Yeah.
But do you need specific oxygen or will any old oxygen do?
All right, so you're in that. Okay, I was not seeing it in that sense.
Okay,
right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That was interesting, though. Nice move. You know, same with water, right? Do you need Dasani water? Will tap water do? Depending on where you are. But, and I know that there is this belief. I'm not going to go so far as to say faith, but I'm not so sure I could be as strong as to say belief, that there is some sort of basic, foundational, the word that's vogue that I've seen recently, core curricular content that is needed in order to be literate. I'm not sure I believe that. And even the six things that I outlined them as languages or aspects of language rather than skill, because you can be fluent in a language without knowing all aspects of a language. I could get by my entire life without the word river, for example. Wouldn't matter. I could get by my entire life, and people do, without knowing how to use an apostrophe. Yeah, you see what I mean? So
if I
Well, there is, right? It's an interesting, what we used to mean by fluent and what we now mean by fluent, right? And I spend more time. Pardon?
By what level you're getting by? Where are you getting by? Because yeah. You can get by without apostrophe in a certain level of their culture. So
but now,
American.
No, but that's fine. But that's great because we can talk about apostrophes and it's not personal anymore. So, well, but it is personal in a different sort of way. You know what I hate? I'll tell you. I hate when people use the plural sense of a verb for singular mass nouns.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, man. Now, you think people badly use apostrophes. Even more people do that, and there is not a common knowledge that this is an error. Okay? So people who are quite literally considered to be fluent, expert, professional, Harvard-educated, Harvard-employed, are making this mistake. So, what do you mean by fluent? Right? It's not about, first of all, necessary and sufficient conditions. Wittgenstein talks about family resemblances. You know, there's kind of a soft target that we sort of hit. There isn't a fixed boundary anymore. And there was another point I was going to make. Oh, well. Nope, lost it. Similar to that point, only subtly different. But I was busy thinking of the last bit. And the last bit was really the most important. And it was, if you don't have this authoritative knowledge, if you don't have this authoritative way of getting knowledge, if you do not have a society that is well grounded in being literate, in doing basic science, basic math, any of these things, you get societies that come to believe fictions as fact, right? The foundational basis of knowledge in the society begins to drift. Now, just as an aside, I would say that's far more likely in a television age than an internet age, and the evidence, I think, speaks volumes. But I don't need to go there. Will Richardson, in a recent blog post, maybe some of you saw it, came up with a very interesting example and a good example. he was, for some odd reason, in his class talking about the color of blood. Let me ask, how many of you believe blood is red?
Me. All the time or some of the time?
That's if it's believe.
Okay. Okay. But isn't that...
You need more of your definition.
See, there is a, oddly, non-zero set of people that believes that blood is blue in the body and red outside the body when it's exposed to oxygen. Now, I say believes because it's not true. I won't ask if any of you believe that, although I sort of did. It's not true. Blood is red. Blood is always red. Sometimes it's dark red, but it's red. And there's plenty of ways to prove that. One way of proving that oxygen has nothing to do with it is to draw blood into a sealed container, like you do when you're giving blood. And when you're giving blood, you look at the blood, yeah, that's red. And it has not been exposed to oxygen. Someone will come along later and say, yeah, but it was exposed to light. There's an internet meme that goes... Anyhow. Will Richardson, he teaches where? Virginia, I think. All of his class believed this and argued vehemently for it. And now, obviously, they could never have had any evidence to show them that blood is blue inside the body. And then he gave them, you know, here's how you know. They still said, no. He had to go find authorities to convince them. And even then, they weren't convinced because the authorities that he asked, people at blood donor clinics, thought that blood was blue inside the body. So the first lesson there is you can't trust the authorities. And I think that's a really important lesson. I have an article I put online once a long time ago, how to evaluate websites, because there's all kinds of these how to evaluate websites things out there, and the very first thing they say is, you know, make sure the source of the website is authoritative. And my response is, don't do that! They lie. Or sometimes they're just wrong. Or sometimes they're just out of date. You know, there are lots of authoritative, very authoritative websites out there that say there are 9 planets. I mean, this happens. So you have to learn how to evaluate for yourself. Learning how to evaluate for yourself is more important than having an authoritative source for content, hands down. And so the question isn't, how can we be sure we have the right content? How can we be sure that people will get the right information? But how can we be sure people are able to evaluate content, to critically reflect, to look at evidence, those sorts of things? And again, I don't mean to keep coming back to those 6 things, but I will, because this is what they were designed for. Those 6 things, syntax, semantics, pragmatic, blah, 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 those are the mechanisms that are used to comprehend language, but also to conduct these sorts of critical evaluations. Does it fit a known pattern? Or does it violate a known pattern? Is it semantically grounded as truth or meaningful, or is it not so? Is it being applied out of context? Did it take into account change? All of these things. So if people can become literate in that sense, then they are critically reflective. Then it doesn't matter where the content came from, they're able to deal with it. And in fact, then it's better that they get some good content, some bad content, so that they're aware that they're living in an epistemologically questionable environment. That's my answer.
Steve, I wanted to 2 additional questions earlier. Cindy and Ed, and then Alan, hold that thought.
If these are too long, tell me. I'm trying to give you complete answers, which is my tendency, but if you prefer brief answers, I can do that too. I just want to be sure you're happy with it.
I'm just interested in your thoughts about sort of the restrictions of institutions. For example, I built a course similar to what you're talking about. It's communications for new media. Where you were talking about, I think, with your grasshopper, one of those. And, you know, students really are charged with come up with an agenda. It can be journalistic. You can advertise something. You can sell something. Whatever you want to do, then go find whichever social media tools you want. Go do it. And, like, that works great. But first of all, I'm restricted by Angel, which is our course management system.
Well, you know my answer to that.
And you know, I can think, well, next term I want to put, which is what I thought of in the first place, put the discussions in Facebook. Because Facebook, to me, feels like, in a way, that Angel makes me just want to punch things off. But then you have the issue of, you know, then people saying, okay, but how do you grade it? How do you know students are there? You know, we have student services, you know, like Tom talked about David this morning, which one of his jobs is to make sure students are checking.
Yeah.
So what do you do with a situation like that where you're trying to get students to be free and constructivist than they are, but the environment sort of fights against it?
Yeah, I mean, the question has the form, this is patterns again, right? How do you be free in a prison? How do you promote freedom in a prison? And there are certain limitations on that. And, I mean, I have often been quoted as saying, and even more frequently quoted myself as saying, because I do that, I don't expect change to happen inside the institutions. I expect change to happen outside the institutions, and then finally, after all of society has changed, institutions to be dragged kicking and screaming, caterwauling like crazy into the change. And many that don't adapt to the change to simply die. And so, in a sense, there isn't a good answer to your question. So the best I can do is tell you what I've done, because I've worked in these institutions my entire life. Athabasca University, Assiniboine Community College, the University of Alberta, which is about as ossified an institution as you can find, and then the National Research Council, which is like the government of Canada, which is even more ossified. And they think the 60s are still happening and are trying to stop it. I'm not kidding. And I have always defined my work as the work that I do. And then negotiated with a way to make my job apply to a work that I do. And it's always worked. Now, I'm not saying it will always work for everyone. I'm not even saying it won't get you fired. But I think it does work, and I think it probably does work more effectively than people realize. You know, you read those business self-help books and that. And they say things like, you know, create your own job inside the corporation. You know what I mean? You've seen those? That's what you do. That's literally what you do. That's literally the way to adapt, because if it's a good change, eventually the institution will adopt it. You may have to change institutions for it to be adopted. I did several times. But nonetheless, that's the approach to take. It's a crappy answer, isn't it? But I don't know what else to say. I mean, that's what I did. I went to Assiniboine Community College, and they said they were just setting up something called distance education and new instructional media. And they made me a design specialist in that. So I had a ridiculously long title, and nobody knew what it meant. And the first thing I did was to make a website for the college. The reaction of the college was, but we cannot host the website. You can't run web servers in our kind of network environment. So what I did is, I have a computer at home. It was a Windows 3.1, I think it was still, yeah, it definitely was 3.1, because I had the 8.3 file name length restrictions, which if you look at my old website, I have a page called copyright.htm, copyright.htm. It's not because I can't spell, because I had 8 characters to work with. So anyhow, I forget the name of it, but it was just a little play web server that you could install on a Windows machine. I installed it on a Windows machine at home. It was back before the days of dynamic IP addresses, so everything worked fine. Went to the office, opened up my web browser, which was like Mosaic. Accessed my web server at home, worked great. So I have a 3.1 computer on my desk at the office. I tried to install the same software on my office computer, no problem. Now, I did have a dynamic IP on my office, but I knew that. And so I went to computer services where they had said, we cannot support a web server. I said, I'm running a web server on my desktop. Here's the URL. Open it up and you'll see. And they open it up and there's a web server running on their network that they said they can't run a web server on. So that's how I got the job of designing the college's website. And they found some web server specifically for the Novell network that they used and may still use. same with the web course, first web course. The thing that I'm most well known for in the world is not instructional design or anything like that. It's for a website called Stephen's Guide to the Logical Fallacies. It's the ancestor of critical literacies. And I put that online to prove that you could put learning materials online to Cinnabon. I put that on my own website because the very first thing I did after I had my own web server, I thought, I'm not going to run a web server. I'm not stupid. So I got a website with a local internet service provider, and so I created my own website. And one of the very first things I put on my own website was Stephen's Guide to the Logic of Fallacies. Instant hit. Ridiculously popular. It was actually quoted in Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy for a number of years. Then they dropped it, and I was devastated. I'm no longer officially a philosopher. But it's my own fault because I did not update it since 1995. And I could go on, but this is what I've done every step through my career, right, is develop something outside the parameters of my job. Prove it works, and then it becomes my job. And I've done that over and over and over. And literally, the only reason I'm here giving this talk is I did that. I'm not smarter than any of you. I'm not more experienced than any of you. I'm just less likely to do what I'm told. and that literally is the difference. And maybe isn't even the difference, because I'll bet you there are among this group people who don't do what you're told. And you're probably the ones that, when I worked with Athabasca University, I was known as a problem user. Because I used the university's internet, or the university, not the internet, because they didn't really have it. I used the university's central computer system to install and run what was called a MUD, a multi-user dungeon, which is a multi-user gaming environment. And so I ran that. Now, mind you, I live, like Athabasca University is in Athabasca. I'm living in a little town about 500 miles, or no, not that far, maybe 350 miles from Athabasca. I was going to say 500 kilometers, but then I realized, no, escape, and then I said miles. Oh, wait, no, the number's wrong. that's how I think. So, problem user. But that was what got me my job at Assiniboine, because I was pretty much the only person in the world not quite. There was maybe a couple dozen others who had experience using MUDs as academic environments. So, and it's funny because the Assiniboine thought they were hiring me to do MUD stuff. And I did do some MUD stuff. We ran a conference. Nobody had thought to do that before either. But, and we did that with the Canadian Association of Distance Education, which was Canada's national distance education. People noticed at Assiniboine when I did something for Kate. And then I did something completely different at Assiniboine. They didn't know what to make of it. And that's what I do at NRC. Grasshopper, I've showed you Grasshopper, not an official project. They hate Grasshopper. they don't want anything to do with it. They want me working on, they wanted me working on collaborative content creation for learning management systems, and I did that because I don't want to be fired. I have four cats to support. But I work on Grasshopper, and I did that mostly on my own time. My radio station. Do you think they know I have a radio station?
Two people do.
Let's see what we're up to right now. Is it still two? It might still be two.
Hey, did you still ask?
Yes.
So that's.
Oh, then we got a few more of those. We have about a half hour.
Yeah.
Arguably, the ultimate open source is experiential learning.
Yeah.
Yet, it doesn't seem that the so-called open source movement has really embraced experiential learning beyond the experiential learning that can be done on the internet. And I wonder if you thought much about that. Why is there that gap between prior learning, experiential learning,
and open sources? I have. There will be things that I haven't thought of or thought about, and I will actually admit it when I say I haven't thought about it. But I gave a talk at a conference to an open source developers conference, and it was kind of interesting because I gave that talk, got on a plane, flew to Saskatchewan, gave a talk to educational theorists, so it was all very cathartic. Because I gave this talk, and it was about learning networks and open learning and all of that, and it was to open source software people, and their main reaction was, it was radical, and it would never work. It's just killed me. It's like, what do you mean it'll never work? You guys are open source people! which resulted in a really good talk in Saskatchewan, a couple of days later, because I did nothing between the talk in Holland and the talk in Saskatchewan, but stew on the fact that open source people thought that what I was proposing was radical and unworkable. And my conclusion is open source people are not educational theorists. They understand software. Learning, not so much. And for that matter, community formation even, not so much. A lot of open source communities are dysfunctional. They have, and if you've worked in open source, and I see the ones who have because they're nodding,
you're all geeks.
Pardon?
You're all geeks.
They're all geeks, yeah. They're all geeks, and they function in what they believe is a meritocracy, but it isn't. And I've worked with people who, in real life, who come out of those communities, and it's the old saying, what movie does that come from? Not The Matrix. Does not play well with others. And I mean, they wear that on their t-shirts, and which is the t-shirt they wear. I'm just kidding. So. It's funny, the open source people really did hit on something. The best way to learn about software is to get in there with a community of people and build it. And yet they didn't realize what they had learned. It didn't click. They hadn't made the connections to other disciplines, which is not surprising because the vast bulk of them are young and inexperienced. They're cutting their chops, literally, doing open source software. And eventually someone at Google or whatever will notice them and they'll get hired, or they'll enter the mainstream in some way, and then they'll not be open source software because they don't have time anymore. Except the good ones, working in an institution and realizing the constraints, you see how I segue back to the previous question, will still have projects on the side because they can't let go because they're good and they want to keep doing stuff. But they still won't have learned that the same approach applies to other things. And so, yeah, it's funny. You get open source people thinking that they need to take language classes, like to learn French or whatever, and not realizing, oh, I could just learn French the way I learn software. It just, and it, which is funny because it's both learning languages, but it just doesn't click in their own mind. It's an interesting phenomenon. And the open source people I've talked to, you really have to argue with them. And if you've argued with open source software people, you know that's not a pleasant thing to do, in order to get them to see this, that this does apply outside software. That was one of my shorter answers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. An outsider to some extent to this particular conversation. There is a radical potential in what you are describing because it transcends content. Institutions mm-hmm. have been obsessed with content.
Mm-hmm.
The open source world says you're talking up with three, there's too much content, people learn content in different ways, chuck it, we can't do it. You open up the greatest possibility of resources for people to learn in the greatest number of ways possible, which responds to all of the, you know, learning style approaches. I mean, it's a
mm-hmm.
it's a massive critique of any kind of content-oriented notion of what an institution is about.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, then you develop, and this I think goes back to something you were saying, which is why I walked in, maybe you said this, to a place like, you know, Western Governors?
Yep.
Okay. So a place like Western Governors comes in and says, we agree with you. Let's just say a place like that, or whatever state could be.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, you know what? We agree. Forget it. We don't care about the content. However, what we will develop is the most elaborate evaluation system in the world. Because we are still an institution,
mm-hmm.
and we have to have criteria for evaluation. So we're going to flip things around. We will deliver no content. All we will deliver is a fascinatingly multi-layered systematic method of evaluating. Because the moment of evaluation has to persist in
mm-hmm.
order for the institutions to have any legitimacy. So that's why all this stuff, like that Ed was mentioning about PLA, for example. Right?
Yep.
The only way it can be legitimated is if there are criteria for evaluation. So I guess my question to
yeah.
you is, if that is the case, if there is a victory in saying goodbye content, and there is an embracing of hello evaluation, which is what all this outcome stuff exists
in. Mm-hmm.
How do you, from your vantage point, keep open the content thing? Do you say we need to? Is it possible to develop an open evaluation model? Because what is the evaluations thing, which we're now at Empire State going to get blasted with, is you've got to name how you are evaluating. So my question is there a radical moment in the evaluative model that is parallel to the radical moment in the content model?
Yes, twofold. I'll preliminary, I'll observe that the very same mistake is being made by people like Sir John Daniel and the backers of the OERU concept, where they've accepted open educational resources. They have grudgingly accepted, after first considering flaky, and that's a quote of Sir John Daniel, open pedagogies, they've grudgingly accepted that, but they draw the line at evaluation, right?
He was here, not so recently. Yeah. That's exactly the...
Of course he was. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Everywhere I've been, Sir John has been there before me. I've only ever met him once and didn't go well. Anyhow, totally off topic. Well, but it's not off topic because this is the model he promotes. This is the model OERU promotes. This is the model in the polite circles, all right? And it's the wrong model, and it's not going to work because it's a model based on a single standard. It's a model based on a centralized, authority-based evaluative system. This doesn't work in teaching. We know that. It doesn't work in teaching methodology. We know that. It doesn't work anywhere across the board. It's not going to work here. And Western Governors University is kind of an example of that. And there are other examples that have been tried and not been successful. And there will be at least a twofold radicalization of this model. I don't want to say it quite that way, but I'm sort of reflecting your question back to you. I do that. I reflect when I have a... Never mind. The two parts are this. Part number one is you decentralize evaluation. And people are going to have a moment about that. And this is already underway. Why on earth would you have one single evaluation agency? How does that make sense? Right? Especially when once they start piling these layers on layers on layers of criteria and competency sets and all of that. And especially when it transpires, as it will transpire, that the people who are being graduated using this method are unqualified. Because it won't work. I guarantee you it won't work. All of this is an effort to have non-experts evaluate. That's what this is. It's a way of trying to get away with some kind of automated or mechanized or systematized system to handle the evaluation. And that's what Common Core is. That's what WGU is. That's what OERU is. It's being done under the auspices of credentialization, quality standards, and all of that. But it's in practice being done under the principle of McDonaldization. Everything will be a quarter pounder. And that's not how evaluation works in the real world. This is the conversation, those of you who were with me at lunch, how do you evaluate a plumber? Do you apply an evaluation metric to a person to see if they've done this, 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 and this right, and that makes them a plumber? Or do you ask another plumber? Is this guy a plumber? Well, let me see. Oh, yeah, he's a plumber. Right? We get plumbers. Plumbers recognize that other people are plumbers. That's how we know somebody is a plumber. Or if you're good at plumbing yourself, you can see that somebody else is a plumber. And the mechanisms we use are kind of formalized ways of trying to do that. They're kind of like landing checklists in airplanes, right? We want to make sure that they don't forget anything because people forget. But it's not the landing checklist that lands the plane. It's the pilot. And the same thing here. And so we're going to decentralize evaluation because we want evaluation in the end to be an evaluation by people who are expert in the discipline. We want plumbers evaluating plumbers, and so the Plumbers Academy will do that. We want CGAs evaluating CGAs, so CGA will do that. Already does that. We want lawyers evaluating lawyers. Well, we got that too already. We want electricians evaluating electricians. What we don't want, we know this for sure, we don't want politicians evaluating people to see whether they're plumbers. We know this. We're not there. We've got systems and structures in place where it is, for all practical purposes, politicians evaluating. But we know intuitively, and there's plenty of empirical evidence to show that the people who evaluate plumbers are plumbers. And people with leaky pipes are also able to make a judgment. So, yep.
Here's what I don't understand about that answer.
Okay.
The critique of context is a critique of expertise.
No.
The critique of evaluation that you're making is you're just saying the experts are the wrong experts, but we just got to bring the right experts. So that if you could learn plumbing in a thousand different ways, and people have learned plumbing in a thousand ways.
Mm-hmm.
So to claim there's only one curriculum to learn plumbing is absurd.
Right.
So open it up.
Yeah.
However, at the point of evaluation, we do know what plumbing means because there are plumbers who could be master plumbers who could identify the criteria for evaluation in plumbing. So what I hear, where I'm a little confused by your response, it seems to me there's a distinction between the wrong people are evaluating, politicians are evaluating rather than plumbers. That's different than saying, but I still hold out that in particular, quote, fields or areas, there are indeed experts who do know the criteria. So they should be the people who are evaluating the array of ways in which people are evaluating plumbers.
All right. Very interesting points. Great points. There are experts. Undeniably. I play darts for money. Trust me. There are experts. Right? I wouldn't deny that for the world. Expertise is not the same as content. Right? And in fact, go do the empirical study, right? Go ask highly qualified, I don't know, plumbers, expert chefs, whatever, right? What it is that makes them an expert. 10 chefs, 10 sets of answers. That's why they all have their own book. That's just a joke. But literally, I mean, being an expert in something is not having a certain set of content. It's like knowing a language isn't knowing the meaning of the words. It isn't even just knowing the meaning of the words and knowing the rules of the grammar. Somebody who only knows the meaning of the words and only knows the grammar could even still be illiterate. You'd think they were insane because they're just always inappropriate. That's why the Big Bang Theory is so funny, because they know the language, they know the words, they know the rules, they adhere to the rules ridiculously, and yet they do stupid things. Expertise isn't the knowledge of the content. Expertise is, how do I say this without being trite? I don't want to say it's a whole body thing, that's stupid. It consists largely in what Polanyi called tacit knowledge or ineffable knowledge. I would say it consists largely of sub-symbolic language. This is why I belabored the point in my talk that, you know, you can't put books in heads. And I belabored in my talk you can't even put words in heads. The outcome of that is a lot of knowledge is micro-knowledge. it's below the level of representation, below the level of symbolization. It's what some people incorrectly call muscle memory, right? This phenomenon they call muscle memory is sub-symbolic knowledge. It's the literal forming of connections in the mind and the strengthening and weakening of connections in the minds. That's why Polanyi says you can teach somebody all about how to ride a bicycle, give them complete content knowledge of how to ride a bicycle. He gets on the bicycle, falls, because he doesn't know how to ride a bicycle. I guess I didn't need the sound effect there. So, sorry about that. There's a separation of expertise and content knowledge. Simply, and so this is my point, simply evaluating people for content means that you're not evaluating them for the actual knowledge of having this expertise. So I went the route of you have the wrong people evaluating, right? Maybe I shouldn't have followed that path instead of the other one, but that's okay. But I did it because there's an etymology behind it. There's a reasoning behind it. And the reasoning behind it is if expertise is simply content knowledge, then all you need to do is tick off the boxes. Do they have the content? And anybody can do that, and we can rationalize our whole educational system, have all of our education done by non-experts because it's just evaluating for content. In fact, you can't, because expertise is this sub-symbolic micro-knowledge that you can't even name. You know, you ask the expert, they cannot tell you. You ask yourself. Ask yourself, like literally, seriously, in your own mind right now, those of you who know how to ride bicycles, what is the knowledge of riding a bicycle? You can do it. Every time you get on a bike, well, not every time. Most times you get on a bicycle, you do not fall over. How do you do that? You'll come up with rationalizations, right? But that's what they are. They're rationalizations. Your knowledge of how to ride a bicycle does not consist in that story that you've just told. Although, when somebody asks you, you'll think, well, it must be. But now, you know, you're almost theorizing about your own knowledge. And because you're not really an expert, theorizing badly. And so that's how it happens, and that's how we get this. And the experts will come along. There's no shortage of experts that will tell you the basis of their expertise because they're supposed to be experts. They should know why they're experts, but they don't. Is that, I know that sounds tirade-ish, but I do think that's the most direct response to the question.
I just want to make everyone aware we have about 8 minutes, and so if people want to ask a few quick questions, I think Zenny has a question. I don't know if we'll make it to everyone in 8 minutes, but...
All the evidence suggests that it won't be.
I just happened to be reading the Net Delusion, which I have not completed, but I read parts of it. And there's some component of it that has caused me to start thinking about education. And he's making the claim... he's making a lot of claims, but I'm going to take one little teeny claim that he's been making, is that having free access to information does not necessarily mean that people will actually seek an unlimited amount of education. That in fact, what he's claiming is that they restrict their search amongst all the free information to just what they want to read or just what they want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
It occurred to me that in a certain time, and I was thinking about Daniel when I read it, not you, because I hadn't heard you before, and it seemed to me that his talk was based upon the kind of an idealistic notion that all that free information is out there, and therefore we will go out. And I think we thought too, it's kind of idealistic. You go out and look, you go look this up and that. My grandson looks up stuff on YouTube. That's his sole source of. But the fact is, he's arguing, in fact, it produces the opposite from the democratic tolerance that we would expect. It is, in fact, it's free access to creating small-minded people. And it seems to me that that notion has some relevance to your concept of learning in that the one thing is, they just need guidance. You know, mm-hmm. I want you to have guidance, and I think you're no longer arguing. I just wondered if you thought about that and whether it had any relevance to
it. I have. You didn't expect me to say I haven't.
No, I imagine that you did because I didn't
want to have I mean, there's no shortage of small-minded people to provide evidence for the proposition. So, I mean, there's a prima facie case that has to be responded to here, and I think it's a serious case. And there's two separate ways to respond to it, both of which are equally valid, both of which I think arrive at the same conclusion, but through independent means. The first way is to point out that small-mindedness has always been with us. It's just never been so widely distributed as now. But, I mean, it doesn't mean it wasn't around before. I grew up... Pardon?
It's just louder.
It's a lot louder now and more organized. I mean, I grew up in a small town in rural Ontario, and there were many people there who I considered small-minded. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't, but I thought they were. And arguably, before the internet, with even less diversity of contents and information, there was probably a lot of, what would we call it? Groupthink, small-townishness, clannishness. There's a bunch of different names. The fact that there are a bunch of different names and nuances to how we describe this phenomenon is evidence that this phenomenon existed and was present. That was interesting. Was present before the arrival of the internet. With the internet, other ways of looking at the world, including small-minded ways, are almost forced on you. And people who were able to pretend that in intelligentsia there was no small-mindedness now find it presented to them every day online. They can't get away from it. It used to be you couldn't get away from advertisements. Now you can't get away from advertisements, and you can't get away from socialists or anarchists or whatever. You go to YouTube, everything's on YouTube, right? Every point of view, every perspective, many very distasteful, many very intelligent. The evidence suggests, I would say, the opposite of the phenomenon being described. That, in fact, when you look at what people are looking at online, they are looking at far more diverse sources than they would ever have looked at prior to the existence of the internet. Far more diverse. Like, orders of magnitude more diverse. And I haven't done that empirical study. And so it is a proposition that is still open for empirical verification. I'm not going to claim to have proven it, but I think it's true. And I saw someone shake her head. No.
Sherry Turkle does something on that in her latest Alone Together.
Mm-hmm.
I have it on my Kindle.
You have it on your Kindle. Yeah.
I can't remember exactly what it was, but there are a couple of it. I went digging for that.
Right.
And the concern, correct me if I'm missing a little bit, I can read this too. No, they're really looking and they're living in their own little worlds, and in a sense it's allowing people to live more narrowly.
But which people? How many? Right?
That's the problem with
I haven't read Turkle's book, but if she's simply gone out and observed some people live more narrowly, she hasn't made the point. Because it's a global point. You can't talk about trends across society by saying this individual did this, this individual did that.
Well, let me be specific, then. My history students are looking at, they'll avoid the text, mm-hmm. and they'll go and find sources on the internet that totally support the idea that they came into the classroom with.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll find other sources that will support that particular mm-hmm. idea and avoid any other source. Unless they said no, you're going to have to find a contrary point of view. And they have to show me where that might, what this point of view and why it might be wrong. So they need some direction in using the sources right there, otherwise they can stay within that world.
Yeah. See, again, I'll make the same point. I don't think your history students are a representative sample.
But they are my history students, and that's really all I'm concerned about.
So your response then is your history students are a representative sample of your history students.
Okay.
Point made. So let me take the second approach to this. The first approach deals with society-wide phenomena, not an issue. Okay. Second approach. We talk about networks and interconnections as though they were a single phenomenon. They're not. In fact, and mathematically this can be proven, there is, get my math nouns right, an infinite number of possible ways of building a network. Some networks are better than other networks. Let me give you some obvious examples to make the point. A network of 10 individual entities, none of which is connected to any other. Terrible network, right? Nothing happens in that network. It's almost not a network. All right, so let's go the other extreme. A network in which every entity is connected to every other entity. Well, now we have the opposite problem, right? We had too little noise, now we have too much noise. In fact, there's a sweet spot. And you can map the connectivity of entities to each other. You can map it on a graph from zero to total, and you get an F-shaped curve. And there's a little spot in the middle of that curve that's the sweet spot. And I first learned about it, interestingly, listening to a guy called Francisco Varela talk about immunology networks. He was talking at the University of Alberta Hospital. Varela is an expert in this, and made many of the points that I'm making here better and a decade or two decades earlier than I'm making them. And in immunology networks, there's a sweet spot. And I would draw the graph if I had a board. But there's a certain kind of connectivity such that you're not too connected and you're not too little connected. Okay, well, that's fine. That doesn't give us practical advice, though. But let's look at this a little more closely. We can think of different networks by their characteristics or their shape. And I draw out two kind of paradigmish kinds of networks. Other people have done this too. It's not unique to me. On the one hand, you have what could be, I call it the star network. The simple star network is one single entity connected to all the others. And nobody else is connected. Okay? Now that's one kind of network. You can get a variation on that, which is the hub and spoke network. Hub and spoke network is like the airline systems, right? So you have some entities that are well connected, and then other entities like small towns, you have to go through Chicago, etc. And then expanding further, you have what might be called a mesh network, where it looks like a mesh. Every entity is connected to two or three or four or whatever other entities. So there's this range of different kinds of networks. Okay. Why is this important? Knowledge is a network phenomenon, which means if we want reliable knowledge, we want reliable networks. What is a reliable network with respect to knowledge? One in which, first of all, knowledge can be propagated. Content signals can be propagated through the network with some degree of reliability. So there has to be like a connection throughout the network. But two, that it doesn't happen right away. Right? Because if it did, the instant a signal occurred to one entity in the network, every other entity would have it. And there'd never be any interaction. And it's the interaction that produces the interesting results. It's the interaction that gives us adaptability, that gives us stability in changing environments, etc. So, what are the properties of a network that leads you toward that? Well, it leads you toward a mesh
mesh-type network with some concentration, some clustering, but generally a mesh-type network. So now, what are the principles that lead you toward a mesh-like network? Well, James Siricki talked about some of them in The Wisdom of Crowds. I talked about them explicitly, and I did in my talk, autonomy, diversity, openness, and interactivity. If you design the structure, the physical structure of your networks to promote those four virtues, then the structure of the network will produce a more reliable network, and it's the reliability of the network that promotes the reliability of the knowledge produced by the network. If your history students are connected through a network containing those four properties, they will produce reliable results.
Well, that does bring back the function of an expert. In setting up at least a network that works,
I'm going to have to interrupt. I'm sorry, we're way over, and we have to get ready for the next session. So I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but great. Thank you very much.
Remember, I don't oppose expertise.
Yeah,
I think there are experts.
You guys can take it out in the hallway.
So, for the... how many people? One person listening on Ed Radio. That's our broadcast for today. I now return you to Otto DJ. Thanks a lot.
How are you doing?
Same person the whole time.
How am I doing? I don't know. I had a maximum of three. I have a streaming media server called Icecast set up. It does the actual broadcasting, and then on this Mac, I use a piece of software called Nicecast, and I've integrated that with a piece of software called Sunflower. Sunflower takes the system audio, and instead of going out through the speakers, it sends it to Nicecast. Nicecast takes the signal, shapes it, and sends it to Icecast. Icecast broadcasts it.
This is sort of 24/7, we're following you around.
Oh no, well, I just stopped the broadcast and now it's going to Auto DJ.
Oh.
Which is another piece of software.
One real quick question. Did you read Rainbow's End?
I'm sorry, did I read?